In the very early morning hours over the night of the 3rd of January, an absolutely earth-shattering development took place in Venezuela that captured headlines around the world. The U.S. military began bombarding targets across the country, while U.S. Special Forces launched a rapid late-night raid into the country, seized their sitting president, Nicolas Maduro, along with his wife, Celia Flores, and then just loaded them both up onto a helicopter and flew them out of the country on a journey that eventually ended with them both in New York City, just a few hours later facing criminal charges in American courts. One country effectively kidnapping the sitting head of state of another country like this in an explosive military raid is utterly unprecedented. And there are a million different questions around the operation floating around right now. Why did Trump order the mission in the first place? Why did the operation go so well for the Americans and so disastrously for Maduro? What's going to happen next? Is the U.S. military involvement in Venezuela going to escalate further? And what does it all mean for America, Venezuela, and the rest of the world beyond? I'm going to do my best to answer as many questions around this operation here as possible. So let's start with how the actual raid itself went, and why it was so absurdly successful from a tactical perspective for the Americans. Many months worth of planning, preparation, and escalation took place before the raid was launched. Beginning in August of 2025, the U.S. military began conducting an overt naval buildup in the Caribbean Sea that steadily developed into the largest concentration of U.S. military assets anywhere in Latin America since the end of the Cold War. Eventually, the Navy and Marines concentrated in the area with an amphibious ready group centered around the USS Iwo Jima, an amphibious assault ship, and a carrier strike group centered around the USS Gerald R. Ford, an ultra-modern nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, along with all of their accompanying escort vessels, totaling around 11,000 sailors and Marines and nearly 100 aircraft, while additional aircraft like advanced F-35 fighter jets and B-1 bombers were increasingly forward deployed to air bases in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands nearby. Initially, the Trump administration publicly claimed that this entire military buildup was intended solely to counter drugs and narcotics trafficking into the U.S. And beginning in September, they began an airstrike campaign against boats in international waters that they claimed were smuggling drugs. Between then and the start of the raid, around 4 months later, at least 35 known strikes on various boats and other targets in this campaign were carried out that killed at least 115 confirmed people. Then in December, the pressure continued escalating when Trump declared that the flotilla would begin enforcing a blockade on Venezuela's oil exports that were being ferried by blacklisted tankers, which resulted in the Americans boarding and seizing one of these blacklisted oil tankers off the coast of Venezuela on the 10th of December. At around the same time, the Trump administration labeled Maduro as the head of a foreign terrorist organization. And in late December, the CIA conducted a drone strike on a remote port facility on the Venezuelan coast itself that they allege was being used by the Trendaragua cartel to store drugs at before moving them onto boats for shipping. Although nobody was present at the facility at the time of the drone strike and no casualties were reported, it notably marked the first known time that the U.S. military directly attacked Venezuelan territory itself. And it was a clear message to Maduro of what might be in store for him soon as well. And all the while, the Trump administration was pursuing their real objective of removing Maduro from power in Venezuela with a Plan A and a Plan B. Plan A, they hoped, was that their increasing pressure on Venezuela through the military buildup, the strikes on boats and ports, and the blockade would all convince Maduro that his personal situation was hopeless and compel him to step down from office and surrender voluntarily. And all the while, in case he didn't, Plan B was always to launch the Special Forces raid to seize him through force instead. Behind the overt military deployments and escalation that was going on in the Caribbean, the U.S. was also simultaneously pursuing a deep, covert operation behind the scenes as well, in order to make the option for a raid as highly likely to succeed as possible. In August, at around the same time as the naval buildup began, the CIA managed to quietly insert a small team within Venezuela that was able to gain extraordinary access to Maduro himself. One source speaking anonymously to CNN after the raid reported that the CIA had managed to secure the cooperation of at least one significant individual within the Venezuelan government itself, who aided with tracking Maduro's location and movements. Through months of methodical studying, the CIA was able to acquire accurate intelligence on Maduro's travel patterns, where and how he moved around, where he slept, what he ate, what he wore, and even what his pets were. All of this enabled the CIA to pinpoint the exact location that Maduro would be at on the ultimate night of the raid, the Fort Tiuna military base just to the south of central Caracas, Venezuela's capital, a sprawling military complex and fortress built into the side of the mountains for defense. The CIA's intelligence gathering operation was so insidious and successful that they even managed to acquire detailed knowledge about the internal structure of Maduro's own safe house where he stayed at within Fort Tijuana. This enabled the U.S. Army's Delta Force, the branch of the special forces that would ultimately be tasked with carrying the raid out, to reconstruct a perfect one-to-one replica of Maduro's safe house that they were able to practice and practice and practice storming repeatedly until they had the whole operation down to precise memory. In a similar manner to how the Navy SEALs were able to build an exact replica of Osama bin Laden's safe house that was also based on CIA intelligence in the lead-up to the raid that killed him back in 2011. By late December after Christmas, the Trump administration apparently concluded that after months of trying to build pressure on Maduro, Plan A wasn't working and he wasn't going anywhere without force. On the 29th of December, Trump himself reportedly gave the green light to Plan B instead, and the preparations for the raid rapidly began being set into motion. But for days, the launch of the raid would be consistently delayed due to unfavorable cloudy weather conditions in the area around Caracas that would make the jobs of the helicopter pilots flying in the Delta Force extraction team exceptionally challenging. Finally, on the night of the 2nd of January, the weather broke just enough to clear a possible path for the helicopters to take. And so, at 10:46 p.m. Eastern Standard Time that night, Trump gave the order to launch. And so the pieces immediately began being set into motion for what would become codenamed Operation Absolute Resolve. Trump himself would watch the following events unfold live from his personal residence in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, rather than in the White House's Situation Room, along with a handful of key aides like the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and the CIA Director, John Ratcliffe. Extremely specialized Chinook stealth helicopters with the Delta Force extraction team on board took off from the USS Iwo Jima and flew low, only about 100 feet above the surface of the sea in order to avoid detection on Venezuelan radar systems, skimming their way toward Caracas. The helicopters themselves belonged to the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, alternatively known as the Night Stalkers. Simultaneously, the U.S. committed around 150 additional aircraft, including F-18, F-22, and F-35 fighters, B-1 bombers, and Reaper drones to provide support and cover for the extraction team. These aircraft departed from around 20 different American bases at different times from across the U.S. mainland and Puerto Rico, and then converged together near Caracas just as the helicopters were approaching the coast. In order to clear the path for the helicopters towards the Fort Tijuana complex where they knew Maduro was located, the jets and drones conducted an overwhelming aerial bombardment against key air defense systems and other military targets across Caracas, as well as at this port, which is Caracas's key conduit to the sea, and this airport nearby to the east. As the strikes began pounding their targets, American cyber warfare specialists were also capable of shutting off large sections of Caracas's power grid as well, using undisclosed capabilities, plunging much of the city into darkness and adding to the cover for the helicopters. With most of Venezuela's relevant air defense systems around Caracas apparently knocked offline by the airstrikes, the helicopters crossed over into Venezuelan airspace and hugged the mountainous terrain around Caracas to further conceal their path, before they ultimately arrived at the Fort Tijuana complex and Maduro safe house at 1:01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, just a little over 2 hours after Trump had initially given the order to go. Immediately upon their arrival at the Fort Tijuana complex, the American helicopters began receiving small arms fire from the Venezuelan security and hired Cuban security forces on the ground. And there was a major gunfight as the American forces returned fire. One of the helicopters was apparently struck by the gunfire and lightly damaged, but was still capable of flying. The heavily armed Delta Force extraction team then descended on the Maduro safe house itself, which they had tirelessly rehearsed doing countless times beforehand on their exact replica of the place. They even brought along blow torches with them in case Maduro managed to escape into his panic room, which they knew existed and were prepared to pry open. Trump, apparently, had authorized the team to kill Maduro if he resisted the extraction too heavily, but it ultimately didn't come to that. Delta Force swiftly broke into Maduro's personal quarters, where he reportedly panicked and attempted to flee towards his panic room, as was expected, before the Delta Force was able to tackle and apprehend him before he could get the heavy steel door to the panic room shut. In the end, the Delta Force apprehended both Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, loaded them both back up onto one of their helicopters, and immediately departed in the dead of the night under overhead coverage and suppressive fire by the fighter jets and Reaper drones that were still patrolling above. As they flew out of the country with the president on board, multiple other engagements with Venezuelan and Cuban security forces were reported, but they were ultimately powerless to stop them. Within just 2 hours and 20 minutes of having launched the operation, it was all already over, and the helicopters were all safely back on board the USS Iwo Jima, where they had initially departed from, plus their two additional new guests, the Venezuelan president and his wife. From there, the pair were quickly taken by air to the Guantanamo Bay naval base that the U.S. controls in Cuba, where a jet was waiting for them that immediately took them further to the Stewart Air National Guard base just north of New York City. By that evening, Maduro was in the DEA's headquarters in Manhattan, and moments later, he and his wife were placed into cells at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where they are now expected to be held until their first court appearances. Satellite images captured before and after the raid over the Fort Tiuna military complex show the scale of the damage that was inflicted. Here in these sets of images captured before and after, you can see massive damage that was inflicted by the airstrikes on two different sets of buildings. One set in the left of the image and another set in the right of the image. Further away at the entrance to the Fort Tiuna complex, satellite imagery has also captured the destruction of the guardhouse and the security gate that was at the entrance, which was apparently struck by a missile during the raid. Throughout the course of the raid, there were multiple casualties. So far, Venezuela has reported that 24 of their own security personnel were killed by the American forces during the course of the raid, while the Cuban government has reported that 32 of their separate security personnel, who were defending Maduro as his personal bodyguards, were also killed during the raid, totaling up to 56 Venezuelan and Cuban security personnel who were collectively killed, in addition to at least 24 civilians around Caracas who were also killed in the process. On the American side, not a single soldier who participated in the raid was killed, though six were reportedly injured in the helicopter that took small arms fire, though none were critical or life-threatening injuries. With zero fatalities and zero loss in equipment on the American side, 56 inflicted fatalities on the Venezuelan and Cuban security personnel, and the successful capture of Venezuela's sitting president, the entire operation was an astronomical success for the U.S. military from a tactical perspective. But whether or not it will ultimately turn into an actual strategic victory for the U.S. still remains to be seen. And there are many, many long-term strategic problems and consequences concerning just about everything about it. From around the world and within the U.S., there has been a sharp difference in reactions to the raid that have roughly followed along ideological and political lines. The Trump administration deliberately withheld knowledge of the raid from the U.S. Congress until it had already been launched, and never secured any congressional approval for it, which has especially sparked anger among the Democrats in Congress. After the raid had happened, the Trump administration asserted that they never informed or consulted Congress ahead of time due to fears that doing so would result in leaks that would have undermined the element of surprise and compromised the mission. Nonetheless, it appears that some leaks happened anyway. Very suspiciously, just 1 week before the launch of the raid, a brand new anonymous account was created on the online betting market Polymarket that placed tens of thousands of dollars worth of bets on the platform that Maduro would be out of office by the end of January. Following the conclusion of the raid just a few days later, these bets netted the anonymous account more than $409,000 in profits, which has led to a lot of speculation that whoever placed the bets was someone from within the administration who possessed insider knowledge. The leadership of Argentina, Ecuador, Ukraine, and Israel have put forward statements in support of America's actions, while the leadership of countries like Panama, Canada, the UK, France, Germany, and the EU have put forward more neutral-sounding statements. Many other countries have sharply condemned America's seizure of Maduro, including other Latin American countries with current left-wing governments in power like Cuba, Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, in addition to other countries from around the world like Spain, South Africa, Iran, and notably Russia and China. A statement released by the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs concerning the raid is perhaps the most ironic statement that anyone will release all this year. It reads, "The United States committed an act of armed aggression against Venezuela. This development gives rise to deep concern and warrants condemnation. The pretext used to justify these actions are untenable," which basically reads like a burglar who's upset that another burglar broke into a different house. During the opening days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, the Russian military attempted a strikingly similar operation to abduct the president of Ukraine that went disastrously wrong by comparison. Russian special forces infiltrated the Ukrainian capital with direct orders to seize President Zelensky, while elite Russian airborne units aboard helicopters stormed the nearby Hostomel airport to reinforce them and facilitate Zelensky's extraction. Instead, it ended up turning into a bloodbath for the Russians, with hundreds of their most elite paratroopers getting killed and multiple shot down helicopters before they gave up without securing any of their objectives. Showing that these kinds of helicopter extraction missions are significantly more difficult and high risk than the Americans make them appear. Russia's condemnation of what America just did in Venezuela when they themselves tried and failed at doing the exact same thing just 4 years previously in Ukraine rings as especially hollow. The Russians are upset at the removal of Maduro from power because he was historically one of their biggest arms clients. Since the mid-2000s, the Venezuelans under Chavez and later Maduro purchased more than $20 billion worth of military equipment from Russia, with any further purchases now a pretty open question. Especially after all of the Russian air defense systems that the Venezuelans purchased effectively did nothing to stop the Americans from seizing their president. It is also yet another deeply embarrassing blow to Russia's image as a supposed global great power. Ever since Russia started getting ridiculously bogged down fighting their war in Ukraine, they've been unable to commit serious resources abroad, and their foreign allies that they used to prop up and support have been dropping like flies. Armenia, their CSTO ally in the South Caucasus, repeatedly lost wars to Azerbaijan and had to suffer through witnessing the complete collapse of Nagorno-Karabakh. The Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria completely collapsed at the end of 2024. And now, Maduro has been removed from power in Venezuela, which only further reinforces this perception that Russia is simply incapable of protecting their friends right now. China's reaction to the raid, like many others, has been very strongly negative. A spokesperson for the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs wrote on X that China is deeply shocked by and strongly condemns the U.S.'s blatant use of force against a sovereign state in action against its president. Such hegemonic acts of the U.S. seriously violate international law and Venezuela's sovereignty, and threaten peace and security in Latin America and the Caribbean region. Notably, just hours before the raid seized Maduro from his residence, he was busy meeting with top Chinese diplomats, who were still present in Caracas at the time when the bombings and helicopter assaults started, no doubt adding to China's sense of indignation at the whole thing. There were some analysts who had begun arguing that America's raid and capture of Maduro, a leader of a nation they didn't like, will set a dangerous precedent for both Russia and China to follow in Ukraine and Taiwan. But I personally don't really think so. Like I already said, Russia already set this precedent themselves in 2022, when they blatantly tried to abduct the president of Ukraine in the opening shots of the Ukraine invasion. They were just bad at it and failed. The possible precedent it sets for China is more interesting, but still flawed. The way that China frames the Taiwan issue and the way that America is trying to frame the Venezuela issue in many ways are remarkably similar. Since China claims Taiwan is one of its own provinces that regards as being in rebellion, Beijing asserts that the Taiwan issue is an issue of domestic sovereignty, and that any outside intervention into its own domestic affairs, like an assault on one of their own provinces to restore order, is illegitimate. In a similar fashion, the Trump administration has asserted that the operation to remove Maduro had nothing to actually do with regime change, but was simply a matter of domestic law enforcement instead, executing an arrest warrant against an individual who just happened to be the sitting president of a foreign country. The irony here, of course, is that the Trump administration claims that their raid to remove Maduro was just a domestic issue, while they simultaneously reject Beijing's narrative of Taiwan just being a domestic issue as well. Using a similar argument, China could conceivably assert that a move on Taiwan is simply a law enforcement operation to apprehend the island's renegade leader, currently Lai Ching-te, whom Beijing similarly does not recognize as the island's legitimate leader. However, Taiwan is also nearly without a doubt a much harder place to target than Venezuela was. Taiwanese forces possess significantly more competent and well-funded armed services than Venezuela, with dramatically more advanced modern air defense systems that are provided by the US. In order to pull off a raid similar to what the Americans just did in Venezuela, China would have to strike hundreds of targets in Taiwan in order to clear a path, rather than the dozens in Venezuela. And by that point, that would already basically be a full-scale war. Venezuela under Maduro was also, without a doubt, the most geopolitically aligned country to China in the Western Hemisphere as well. China was one of the very few countries that was willing to openly defy U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and trade with them for oil, although the relationship has been a very lopsided one in China's favor. Only 5% of China's total oil imports were coming in from Venezuela, while China alone accounted for an overwhelming 80% of Venezuela's oil exports, meaning that China was a lot more important to Venezuela as a buyer than Venezuela was to China as a seller. If the U.S. government manages to fully take control of the Venezuelan oil industry now that Maduro is out of the picture, China might lose out on what historically had represented 5% of their oil imports, which isn't insignificant, but they'll also have fairly easy options to replace the loss. China could come to rely more on Russia for increased oil imports to fill in the gap, which ironically might just end up pushing Beijing and Moscow ever closer together. And this gets us into the many, many problems relating to the raid and what comes next. All this time later, the Trump administration has still not put forward a clear or even sound strategic reason for having launched the raid in the first place. Officially speaking, the administration's stated justification for the raid was to arrest Maduro on charges of alleged drug trafficking and narco-terrorism. Trump himself has repeatedly claimed that Maduro was supposedly responsible for smuggling gigantic amounts of narcotics into the U.S., but the facts compiled and put forward so far don't really support this argument. According to U.S. drug enforcement data recently compiled by the Congressional Research Service, only a minuscule amount of the fentanyl, cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin that finds its way into the U.S. originates from Venezuela. The report found that more than 85% of the heroin that enters the U.S. originates from Mexico. Virtually zero fentanyl is produced in Venezuela at all, while the vast majority of cocaine that enters the U.S. originates from Colombia still, with Venezuela being primarily used only as a transshipment point rather than as a major supplier and producer in its own right. Moreover, many, many analysts have questioned whether or not the so-called Cartel of the Suns, the alleged drug trafficking cartel that the Trump administration asserts Maduro is the leader of, even exists at all. Without further actions against where most of the drugs entering the U.S. are actually coming from, like Mexico and Colombia, removing Maduro alone will do very little to actually put a dent in America's drug problem. So, if it wasn't actually about drugs like the administration has consistently tried to claim, what was it really all about? Some have argued, of course, that it was supposedly actually about regime change and restoring the democracy in Venezuela that used to exist prior to the rise of Hugo Chavez and the Chavismo socialist regime in the late 1990s. But then in a news conference that Trump gave the afternoon after the raid, he appeared to downplay the regime change and restoring democracy to Venezuela were actual objectives or even concerns of his. He asserted during this conference that the United States was going to temporarily run Venezuela now until it was deemed appropriate to hand over in a transition. During the same conference, Trump hardly even mentioned the popular Venezuelan Democratic opposition at all. When point-blank asked if he would support the primary opposition leader becoming president next, Maria Corina Machado, Trump bluntly responded that he didn't believe she had either the necessary support or the respect within the country to pull it off. During the last presidential election in Venezuela in July of 2024, Maduro banned Machado from being able to run against him out of fear of her popularity and the odds of her being able to win. Machado and her party then put forward Edmundo Gonzalez to run against Maduro instead, who by virtually all independent tallies probably managed to decisively win the 2024 election with close to 70% of the total vote, which was also indirectly a vote for Machado. Maduro ultimately refused to release the government's own records of the election data, claimed that he won instead, and then stole the election and repressed everyone who protested against it, sending both Machado and Gonzalez into exile abroad. So there was initially this belief that the raid to remove Maduro was designed to install this waiting opposition government in exile into power in Venezuela. But Trump has consistently downplayed that this is actually his intention ever since the raid. Instead, Trump has seemingly welcomed the continuation of power in Venezuela by the same greater Chavismo regime, with Maduro's former vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, having since been formally sworn in as Venezuela's interim president. The Trump administration has claimed that behind the scenes, Rodriguez is now fully cooperating with all of the U.S.'s demands, despite her public condemnations and defiant speeches urging Venezuelans to take to the streets to protest the seizure of Maduro. It is likely that the Trump administration has calculated that forcing full-blown regime change on a Venezuela by installing the democratic opposition would result in more chaos than it would probably be worth. Likely fearful of the prior legacies of America's disastrous regime change operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Far easier, the administration probably believes, to just remove Maduro through force and threaten that they'll do it again to pressure the new leaders of the regime into doing their bidding. There are even some rumors that Rodriguez potentially even collaborated with Washington ahead of the raid, both in order to remove Maduro from the way of power and in exchange for an understanding from Washington to keep the overall regime in place without him. What the Trump administration really appears most interested in Venezuela is the country's enormous oil reserves, the largest of any country on the planet, even more than Saudi Arabia. During his press conference hours after the raid, Trump himself mentioned oil no less than 24 times, and he specifically asserted that the U.S. would now be running Venezuela to extract its oil wealth in order to compensate American firms for losses they incurred during prior nationalizations of the country's oil industry in the 1970s and the 2000s. Back in 2007, Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, seized all of the assets in Venezuela that belonged to both Exxon and ConocoPhillips, after they refused to renegotiate with them on renewed ownership structures on their operations in the country. Since then, both companies and other Western energy companies have filed a combined $60 billion worth of outstanding claims against the Venezuelan government for the seizure of these assets in both American and international courts, which continue to remain outstanding and unpaid, and which Trump is now demanding the regime without Maduro repay, which is probably not really even possible for reasons that I'll get into later. Additionally, Trump has declared that another of his objectives is to revamp Venezuela's oil production, which used to be among the highest rates of production in the world. Back in the mid-1990s, before the rise of the Chavismo regime, Venezuela was producing about 3.5 million barrels of oil per day. But since then, Venezuelan production has cratered over the years due to a combination of gross mismanagement, long-deferred maintenance, decades of brain drain of experienced technicians, and international sanctions down to just a little over 800,000 barrels per day, a mere fraction of its historical potential and less than 1% of the global supply currently. Trump has repeatedly stated that he will make it so that major American oil companies like Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and Chevron can go in and invest billions of dollars into the country's decrepit oil industry to get it all back up and running again for the mutual benefit of both Venezuela and the U.S. alike, with the increased production and revenues, in his mind, serving both to help rebuild Venezuelan society and repay the American energy companies billions of dollars worth of lost property. But actually doing that is going to be way, way, way harder than Trump may believe. And it doesn't really make any sense as a justification for the raid that took out Maduro either. It's been estimated by Kepler, a data firm, that merely getting Venezuela back to the level of oil production that it had back in the late 2010s before the major U.S. sanctions began to bite, roughly 1.5 million barrels per day, would require a capital injection of around $10 billion to pull off and would take 2 to 3 years to accomplish, pushing the accomplishment near the end of Trump's term in office. In order to then go further and restore Venezuela's oil production back to anywhere close it was during its heyday before Maduro entered into office, another energy consultancy called Rystad Energy has estimated that it would require an absolutely colossal investment of $110 billion to accomplish. And it would take as long as an entire decade to actually pull it off, which is notably double the amount of capital that all of the American oil majors invested combined globally in 2024. And even with all of that time and capital invested into Venezuela, it would only manage to get the country back up to a production rate of about 2.5 million barrels of oil per day, which is only about half of the oil that Texas alone is currently producing right now. The enormous scope of this operation that's required to rebuild Venezuela's trashed oil industry fundamentally requires long-term stability and security in the country, along with a certainty that the government will actually honor their contracts and not expropriate the foreign companies' investments and assets again, none of which are conditions that currently actually exist, especially with the overall Chavismo regime ultimately seeming to still remain in place even without Maduro at the helm of it. Understandably, literally none of the major U.S. energy majors have so far expressed any serious interest in actually increasing their investments into Venezuela's oil sector. While Exxon's leadership has even reportedly told the Trump administration after the raid that they still view Venezuela as being completely uninvestable anyway. Another major problem is that the nature of Venezuela's oil, which is very heavy, sour, and full of impurities, makes it more expensive and technically complex than other kinds of lighter oils to extract. Most of Venezuela's skilled oil technicians have fled the country over the past decade plus of history, meaning that to make all of this work, the foreign energy companies would also have to inject a huge amount of human capital into Venezuela in addition to all of their huge amounts of financial capital. Worse still, because of how expensive it is to drill Venezuelan oil, the price per barrel that's considered the break-even rate for Venezuelan oil production is greater than $80, according to Wood Mackenzie, another energy consultancy. And currently, because there is a gigantic glut of oil that's currently on the market with more supply than there is demand, the price per barrel has been hovering at only around $50 instead. Well below the possible break-even point in Venezuela. Meaning that oil projects there would currently be operating at a net loss until prices increase again at some uncertain point in the future. And all of this, understandably, makes U.S. energy majors even less incentivized to actually invest any of their meaningful capital or time into Venezuela. The project is extremely expensive, it's extremely risky, and it's very volatile with the Chavismo regime ultimately still in power. And it's also highly likely to be unprofitable for years to come. What a proposition to offer. And all the more puzzling when the U.S. already produces more oil than any other country in the world right now, while next door Guyana has abundant oil reserves of their own that are far easier and cheaper to extract in a much more politically stable environment than in Venezuela. Even if the production could end up becoming revitalized, the more that the Trump administration diverts the razor-thin profit margins towards America, the less there'll be left over for rebuilding and redeveloping Venezuelan society, which will probably lead to resentment at the regime's collaboration with America and diminish its popularity in increasing the odds of a coup happening that undoes the whole process, unless America reintervenes with force through the military again. The price of oil is also already so low because of this global glut of supply that it's near the dangerous tip-over point where it will even become unprofitable for most domestic U.S. oil producers too. Adding even more supply onto the global market from Venezuela to the tune of potentially nearly 1 to 2 million barrels more per day would push down the price even further, probably harming America's own oil producers in the process. Assuming, in a fantasy land, that the U.S. actually could manage to get Venezuela's oil production levels back to where they historically were before Maduro, it would also pose a significant threat to Canada and their oil export market that largely comes out of the Alberta oil sands. Many of the heavy-duty oil refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast were initially built to handle processing Venezuela's super-heavy crude, which after relations between the U.S. and Venezuela cratered after the rise of Chavismo, were retooled to handle Canada's super-heavy crude from Alberta instead. If the U.S. managed to get significant imports of oil to these refineries coming back in from Venezuela again, it would give the Americans leverage to force down the price of Canadian oil in the U.S. market, which would pose a long-term threat to Canada's and Alberta's economies since they currently rely so heavily on oil exports exclusively to the U.S. market. All of this could provide Canada with a further emphasis to diversify their customers, with a new oil pipeline that they've already started constructing from Alberta to the coast of British Columbia that is increasingly becoming a vital project for securing Canada's own financial sovereignty. A true irony of the whole Maduro raid, if it ends up actually resulting in America taking over and revitalizing the Venezuelan oil industry, is that it could end up pushing Canada and China closer together instead, since it would probably mean cutting out Venezuela's oil supply from China and America's oil purchases from Canada, meaning that it would become logical for Canada and China to simply reconfigure their own relationship, pivoting Canadian oil exports to China instead. So, most of the oil argument that the Trump administration is making for ousting Maduro also doesn't really make much sense when you really start digging into it. The only element of the oil argument that might make sense is how it relates to Cuba. The communist regime in Cuba and the Chavismo regime in Venezuela have been closely aligned since the days of Chavez and continued throughout the Maduro years. For many years, Venezuela provided Cuba with cheap, below-market oil supplies in exchange for Cuban military and intelligence cooperation and medical expertise. But with Maduro now out of the picture, Trump has been clear that another one of his demands of the new leadership in Venezuela is to sever the remaining oil supply to Cuba, which, without a joke, is potentially an existential threat to the Communist Party of Cuba, that is already facing massive energy shortages on the island that are resulting in frequent rolling blackouts. If they can't manage to acquire new supplies of oil from somewhere else besides Venezuela, they stand to possibly start literally running out of it. Regardless of the justifications and the grand strategy involved with removing Maduro, none of which really quite makes a lot of sense, the Trump administration has clarified that it does not intend for the U.S. to control the Venezuelan government directly, but indirectly through continued threats to Rodriguez that a similar fate as Maduro could befall her if she doesn't fall in line with America's demands. Considering that the demands are limited in nature, involving access to the country's oil resources rather than regime change, or even rather than a moderating of the regime's repression, it's probably more likely than not that Venezuela under Rodriguez and the continuation of Chavismo actually cooperates. That isn't to say that it's absolutely a certainty, however. There's always a risk within the Chavismo regime that influential and ambitious hardliners, such as Diosdado Cabello, the interior minister who wields significant influence over the country's paramilitary force called the Colectivos, and who is widely now seen as the second most powerful figure in the country after Rodriguez, might eventually take offense at the new cooperation with Washington and consider a coup. At which point, the Venezuelan army would have to choose which side to back. Thus, there's certainly some element of risk of infighting or even civil war breaking out in the country over this issue in the coming months, as evidenced a couple of nights after the raid, when gunfire erupted across the presidential palace in Caracas that was captured by multiple videos, and which led to a lot of speculation that a coup had already started. But that ultimately turned out to have just been nervous security units firing in the air at one of their own drones that they mistakenly identified as an enemy aircraft. If Rodriguez doesn't fall in line with the demands that the Trump administration expects, or an internal conflict erupts and the country descends into a power struggle, the U.S. may find itself in the position of having to increase its military involvement in Venezuela further, which is broadly unpopular with the American public right now, to say the least. Perhaps most tellingly into the beliefs that went into the Maduro raid is the Trump administration's own release of their national security strategy, which they published only a few weeks before the launch of the raid. In it, the strategy calls for placing the priority of the Western Hemisphere over all the other regions in the world, while it specifically outlines a so-called Trump corollary to the historical Monroe Doctrine, which promises to shut out extra-hemispheric powers like China by denying them, quote, the ability to position forces or other threatening capabilities, or to own or control strategically vital assets in our hemisphere, end quote. Further on, the strategy also rather threateningly reads that the U.S. wants, quote, nations to see us as their partner of first choice, and will, through various means, discourage their collaboration with others, end quote. Seen in the light of Maduro and Venezuela's historically close relationship with China over the past decade, the raid to capture him serves another goal of delivering a very overt warning to China and Russia to stay out of the Western Hemisphere, and that the hemisphere is exclusively within America's own self-declared sphere of influence. It also sends a clear warning to other regional governments across Latin America that if they don't cooperate with the U.S. and drift too close to China instead, their leaders could also be next. In a way, it's also a true return back to form for the United States, who has long meddled in the internal affairs of Latin America with military interventions and clandestine CIA and intelligence operations to influence events in their favor. In 1914, the U.S. deployed troops to occupy the Mexican port city of Veracruz in order to protect U.S. financial interests there. In 1954, the CIA backed a coup that overthrew the democratically elected government in Guatemala that led to decades of brutal civil war and chaos in the country. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy orchestrated the Bay of Pigs fiasco in Cuba, which helped escalate events towards the Cuban Missile Crisis that almost ended the world just a year later. In 1973, the CIA backed another coup in Chile against the democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende, which resulted in the rise to power of Augusto Pinochet and his brutal 17-year-long dictatorship in the country. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration heavily intervened in the affairs of Nicaragua against the socialist Sandinista government by funding right-wing paramilitary death squads that were known as the Contras, that culminated with the Iran-Contra scandal and which inflamed Nicaragua's civil war. And in 1989, in the most analogous comparison to the Maduro raid, President George H.W. Bush ordered a full-scale U.S. military invasion of Panama in order to seize and apprehend Panama's then-leader, Manuel Noriega, on narcotics and drug smuggling charges. After the end of the Cold War, the U.S. entered into a long period of ceasing their big military interventions in Latin America that had been going on almost continually for a century beforehand. But in the new multipolar world that is seemingly emerging in the 2020s, the Maduro raid into Venezuela, the new Trump national security strategy, and the reinvocation of the Monroe Doctrine all herald the return back to the historical norm in the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America, which, as it turns out, had only been briefly dormant throughout the 1990s, the 2000s, and the 2010s. While the raid that captured Maduro turned out to be a textbook tactical success for the Americans with no losses in either lives or equipment, it nearly didn't turn out that way. As new information about the raid has continued trickling out, we've since learned that the pilot flying one of the helicopters during the raid was struck in his leg by 3 bullets fired by the Venezuelan and Cuban security forces who were guarding Maduro. The pilot managed to survive his injuries and was only just barely capable of pushing through to continue piloting it all the way back to safety again. Had the pilot not been as incredibly skilled or the bullets struck him in slightly different locations, the entire operation could have turned out disastrously different with a crashed helicopter deep in hostile Venezuelan territory, and potential U.S. soldier deaths or even prisoners taken by the Venezuelan government who could have then been used as leverage. The raid was a much closer run thing than many of us were initially led to believe. And in the worst case scenario, it could have even developed into a situation like the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia in 1993. One of the most disastrous fiascos in the modern history of the U.S. military that essentially went in the exact opposite direction of the Maduro raid in terms of outcome. Back then, the U.S. military similarly devised a plan to use helicopters loaded up with special forces to launch a rapid raid into the heart of Mogadishu in order to seize 2 high-ranking militants as prisoners and immediately evacuate with them. Like the Maduro raid, this earlier helicopter raid was intended to only last around an hour as a rapid in-and-out exfiltration mission. Instead, it turned into an agonizing 17-hour-long battle after 3 of the American helicopters that were participating in the raid were shot down by militants on the ground, 2 of them deep within hostile territory surrounded by armed enemies that needed to then be defended to the death. The whole affair ended up resulting in the highest number of deaths of American servicemen during a single battle since the Vietnam War, and the capture of an American soldier who was then able to be used by the militants as negotiating leverage. When the order was given to launch the raid to capture Maduro in the same kind of way, there was always a possibility that it could have ended up going in a similar direction. And so, I think that understanding the Black Hawk Down incident as well is a major lesson in what can also happen during these kind of high-risk operations when considering more of them in the future, when they don't end up going exactly as according to plan. And so, I made an entire new documentary analyzing the hour-by-hour moments that took place during the Black Hawk Down incident in a brand new episode in my Modern Conflict series, which takes deeper dives into modern wars, battles, and operations. But because of the inherently violent and controversial details surrounding the Black Hawk Down incident, including details and depictions of excessive violence and terrorism throughout a 17-hour-long battle, my documentary analyzing the whole course of events would never work on YouTube, because it would instantly become demonetized and age-restricted, which means the YouTube's algorithm that's based around showing you ads would never actually be incentivized to show the video to you or to promote it. I deal with very large numbers of my videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they already are, including one of my most recent videos here that attempted to cover the ongoing genocidal events that are taking place in Darfur during the civil war in Sudan. And so that's why I'm uploading all of my documentaries and modern conflicts, including this one covering the Black Hawk Down incident, exclusively to Nebula instead. And why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. And there's never been a better time to sign up, because you can now get 50% off of the annual subscription for just $30 for the entire year. A perfect gift that you can also give to someone for the new year. And there's plenty of new content for you to watch right now. There's Scav, a new documentary series by the Jetlag team that follows the world's largest scavenger hunt. There's multiple new exclusive video essays by Lindsay Ellis, and a new short film by Patrick Willems called The Dinner Plan that features Griffin Newman and Zach Cherry. And of course, Nebula is also still home to some of the best curated and informative documentaries available on the internet today. There's Bobby Broccoli's 17 Pages documentary covering one of the largest scientific controversies of the 20th century, Real Engineering's 16 Days in Berlin, the most detailed Battle of Berlin documentary that's ever been produced, Whenever Productions' The Logistics of X series, and of course, my other Nebula series called Mad Kings, covering the reigns and decisions of modern history's most eccentric dictators, with plenty more originals from myself and other creators planned throughout 2026. I personally treat Nebula as my own sanctuary away from the noise of algorithmically driven sites like YouTube and other social media, both as a creator and as a viewer. There's no AI bots and no AI-generated slop that's clogging up your feed here. We individually choose and vet which creators we actually work with, and that enables us to only work with the best, creators who truly love and take pride in what they do. So, if you want to support me and hundreds of other independent creators who still value our craft and get access to some of the best documentaries and video essays available on the internet that you won't find here on YouTube, you can do so by visiting the link that's down below in the description, by scanning the QR code that's here on your screen, or by clicking the button that's here on your screen and signing up. You'll get 50% off of an annual subscription by doing so, which is just $30 for the whole year or $250 per month, a fraction of the price of YouTube Premium. You can even sign up for a lifetime membership as well with a 40% off discount for $300. If you don't ever want to deal with yet another streaming platform subscription or ads ever again for as long as we both last, I hope that you'll consider signing up or gifting to a friend or a loved one. And as always, thank you so much for watching.